Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to resume with Saki, Hector Humanro, the complete stories of, and we'll do the usual four. Let's begin with the seven cream jugs. The seven cream jugs. I suppose we shall never see Wilfred Pigeoncoat here now that he has become heir to the baronetcy and to a lot of money, observed Mrs. Peter Pigeoncoat regretfully to her husband. Never see Wilfred Pigeoncoat. Well, we can hardly expect to, he replied, seeing that we always choked him off from coming to see us when he was a prospective nobody. I don't think I've set eyes on him since he was a boy of 12. There was a reason for not wanting to encourage his acquaintanceship, said Mrs. Peter. With that notorious failing of his, he was not the sort of person one wanted in one's house. Well, the failing still exists, doesn't it? Said her husband, or do you suppose a reform of character is entailed along with the estate? Oh, of course there's still that drawback, admitted the wife. But one would like to make the acquaintance of the future head of the family, if only out of mere curiosity. Women do not like to admit their actual motives. Besides, cynicism apart, his being rich will make a difference in the way people look at his failing. When a man is absolutely wealthy, not merely well-to-do, all suspicion of sordid motive naturally disappears. The thing becomes merely a tiresome malady. Wilfred Pigeoncoat had suddenly become heir to his uncle, Sir Wilfred Pigeoncoat, on the death of his cousin, Major Wilfred Pigeoncoat, who had succumbed to the after effects of a polo accident. A Wilfred Pigeoncoat had covered himself with honors in the course of Marlborough's campaigns, and the name Wilfred had been a baptismal weakness in the family ever since. So they're all named Wilfred. The new heir to the family dignity and estates was a young man of about 25 who was known more by reputation than by person to a wide circle of cousins and kinfolk. And the reputation was an unpleasant one. The numerous other Wilfrids in the family were distinguished from one another chiefly by the names of their residences or professions, as Wilfred of Hubbledown and young Wilfred the Gunner, but this particular scion was known by the ignominious and expressive label of Wilfred the Snatcher. From his late school days onward, he had been possessed by an acute and obstinate form of kleptomania. He had the acquisitive instinct of the collector without any of the collector's discrimination. Anything that was smaller and more portable than a sideboard and above the value of a ninepence had an irresistible attraction for him, provided that it fulfilled the necessary condition of belonging to someone else. On the rare occasions when he was included in a country house party, it was usual and almost necessary for his host or some member of his family, of the family, to make a friendly inquisition through his baggage on the eve of his departure to see if he had packed up, by mistake, anyone else's property. The search usually produced a large and varied yield. This is funny, said Peter Pigeoncoat to his wife some half hours after their conversation. Here's a telegram from Wilfred saying he's passing through here in his motor and would like to stop and pay us his respects. Can stay for the night if it doesn't inconvenience us. Signed, Wilfred Pigeoncoat. Must be the Snatcher. None of the others have a motor. I suppose he's bringing us a present for the silver wedding. Back when cars were unusual and just getting started, I gather. Good gracious, said Mrs. Peter, as though a thought struck her. This is rather an awkward time to have a person with his failing in the house. All those silver presents set out in the drawing room and others coming by every post. I hardly know what we've got and what we're still to come. We can't lock them all up. He's sure to want to see them. "We must keep a sharp lookout, that's all," said Peter reassuringly. "But these practiced kleptomaniacs are so clever," said his wife apprehensively, "and it will be so awkward if he suspects that we are watching him." Awkwardness was indeed the prevailing note that evening when the passing traveler was being entertained. The talk flitted nervously and hurriedly from one impersonal topic to another. The guest had none of the furtive, half-apologetic air that his cousins had rather expected to find. He was polite, well-assured, and perhaps just a little inclined to put on side. I'm not even sure what that means. I'm not sure I've ever seen that before, put on side. His host, on the other hand, wore an uneasy manner that might have been the hallmark of conscious depravity. In the drawing room, after dinner, their nervousness and awkwardness increased. "Oh, we haven't shown you the silver wedding presents," said Mrs. Peter suddenly, as though struck by a brilliant idea for entertaining the guest. "Here they all are, such nice, useful gifts. A few duplicates, of course." 7 cream jugs, put in Peter. "Yes, isn't it annoying," went on Mrs. Peter, 7 of them. "We feel that we must live on cream for the rest of our lives. Of course, some of them can be changed." Wilfred occupied himself chiefly with such of the gifts as were of antique interest, carrying 1 or 2 of them over to the lamp to examine their marks. The anxiety of his host at these moments resembled the solicitude of a cat whose newly born kittens are being handed round for inspection. "Let me see, did you give me back the mustard pot?" "This is its place here," piped Mrs. Peter. "Sorry, I put it down by the claret jug," said Wilfred, busy with another object. "Oh, just let me have that sugar sifter again, asked Mrs. Peter, dogged determination showing through her nervousness. "I must label it who it comes from before I forget." Vigilance was not completely crowned with a sense of victory. After they had said good night to their visitor, Mrs. Peter expressed her conviction that he had taken something. "I fancy, by his manner, that there was something up," corroborated her husband. "Do you miss anything?" Mrs. Peter hastily counted the array of gifts. "I can only make it 34, and I think it should be 35, she announced. "I can't remember if 35 includes the Archdeacon's cruet stand that hasn't arrived yet." "How on earth are we to know?" said Peter. "The mean pig hasn't brought us a present, and I'm hanged if he shall carry one off." The mean pig. "Tomorrow, when he's having his bath," said Mrs. Peter excitedly, "he's sure to leave his keys somewhere, and we can go through his portmanteau. It's the only thing to do." On the morrow, when alert watch was kept by the conspirators behind half-closed doors, and when Wilfred, clad in a gorgeous bathrobe, had made his way to the bathroom, there was a swift and furtive rush by 2 excited individuals towards the principal guest chamber. Mrs. Peter kept guard outside while her husband first made a hurried and successful search for the keys and then plunged at the portmanteau with the air of a disagreeably conscientious customs official. The quest was a brief one. A silver cream jug lay embedded in the folds of some Zephyr shirts. "The cunning brute," said Mrs. Peter. "He took a cream jug because there were so many. He thought one wouldn't be missed. Quick, fly down with it and put it back among the others." Wilfred was late in coming down to breakfast, and his manner showed plainly that something was amiss. Well, maybe he was going to give him the 8th. I bet that's what it is. "It's an unpleasant thing to have to say," he blurted out presently, "but I'm afraid you must have a thief among your servants. Something's been taken out of my portmanteau. It was a little present from my mother and myself for your silver wedding. I should have given it to you last night after dinner, only it happened to be a cream jug, and you seemed annoyed at having so many duplicates, so I felt rather awkward about giving you another. I thought I'd get a change for something else, and now it's gone." "Did you say it was from your mother and yourself?" asked Mr. and Mrs. Peter almost in unison. The snatcher had been an orphan these many years. "Yes, my mother's at Cairo just now, and she wrote to me at Dresden to try and get you something quaint and pretty in the old silver line, and I pitched on this cream jug." We'd say landed or settled on or hit on. Both the pigeon coats had turned deadly pale. The mention of Dresden had thrown a sudden light on the situation. It was Wilfred the Attaché, a very superior young man, who rarely came within their social horizon, whom they had been entertaining unawares in the supposed character of Wilfred the Snatcher. They got their Wilfreds mixed up. Lady Ernestine Pigeoncoat, his mother, moved in circles which were entirely beyond their compass or ambitions, and the son would probably one day be an ambassador, and they had rifled and despoiled his portmanteau. Husband and wife looked blankly and desperately at one another. It was Mrs. Peter who arrived first at an inspiration. How dreadful to think that there are thieves in the house. We keep the drawing room locked up at night, of course, but anything might be carried off while we are at breakfast. She rose and went out hurriedly, as though to assure herself that the drawing room was not being stripped of its silverware, and returned a moment later, bearing a cream jug in her hands. There are 8 cream jugs now instead of 7. She cried. This one wasn't there before. What a curious trick of memory, Mr. Wilfred. You must have slipped downstairs with it last night and put it there before we locked up, and forgotten all about having done it in the morning. One's mind often plays one little tricks like that, said Mr. Peter, with desperate heartiness. Only the other day I went into town to pay a bill, and went in again the next day, having clean forgotten that I'd... It is certainly that jug that I brought for you, said Wilfred, looking closely at it. It was in my portmanteau when I got my bathrobe out this morning before going to my bath, and it was not there when I unlocked the portmanteau on my return. Someone had taken it while I was away from the room. The Pigeoncoats had turned paler than ever. Mrs. Peter had a final inspiration. Get me my smelling salts, dear, she said to her husband. I think they're in the dressing room. Peter dashed out of the room with glad relief. He had lived so long during the last few minutes that a golden wedding seemed within measurable distance. Silver would be your 50th, I think, or would it be your 25th, and then gold would be your 50th or your 75th. Mrs. Peter turned to her guest with confidential coyness. A diplomat like you will know how to treat this as if it hadn't happened. Peter's little weakness, it runs in the family. Good Lord, do you mean to say he's a kleptomaniac like Cousin Snatcher? Oh, no, not exactly, said Mrs. Peter, anxious to whitewash her husband a little grayer than she was painting him. He would never touch anything he found lying about, but he can't resist making a raid on things that are locked up. The doctors have a special name for it. He must have pounced on your portmanteau the moment you went to your bath and taken the first thing he came across. Of course, he had no motive for taking a cream jug. We've already got 7, as you know. Not, of course, that we don't value the kind gift you and your mother... Hush! Here's Peter coming. Mrs. Peter broke off in some confusion and tripped out to meet her husband in the hall. It's all right, she whispered to him. I've explained everything. Don't say anything more about it. Brave little woman, said Peter with a gasp of relief. I could never have done it. Empty line. Diplomatic reticence does not necessarily extend to family affairs. Peter Pigeoncoat was never able to understand why Mrs. Consuelo Van Bullion, who stayed with them in the spring, always carried 2 very obvious jewel cases with her to the bathroom, explaining them to anyone she chanced to meet in the corridor as her manicure and face massage set. And that's the end of that story about thieving, appearances. The occasional garden. The occasional garden. Don't talk to me about town gardens, said Eleanor Rapsley, which means, of course, that I want you to listen to me for an hour or so while I talk about nothing else. What a nice-sized garden you've got, people said to us when we first moved here. What I suppose they meant to say was what a nice-sized site for a garden we've got. As a matter of fact, the size is all against it. It's too large to be ignored altogether and treated as a yard, and it's too small to keep giraffes in. You see, if we could keep giraffes or reindeer or some other species of browsing animal, there we could explain the general absence of vegetation by a reference to the fauna of the garden. Quote, you can't have wapiti and Darwin tulips, you know. So we didn't put down any bulbs last year, hearkening back to his story on the train with the kids. You could have pigs or petunias, but not both. As it is, we haven't got the wapiti, and the Darwin tulips haven't survived the fact that most of the cats of the neighborhood hold a parliament in the center of the tulip bed, that rather forlorn-looking strip that was intended to be a border of alternating geranium and spirea, has been utilized by the cat parliament as a division lobby. Snap divisions seem to have been rather frequent of late, far more frequent than the geranium blooms are likely to be. I shouldn't object so much to ordinary cats, but I do complain of having a congress of vegetarian cats in my garden. They must be vegetarians, my dear, because whatever ravages they may commit among the sweet pea seedlings, they never seem to touch the sparrows. There are always just as many adult sparrows in the garden on Saturday as there were on Monday, not to mention newly fledged additions. There seems to have been an irreconcilable difference of opinion between sparrows and Providence since the beginning of time as to whether a crocus looks best standing upright with its roots in the earth or in a recumbent posture with its stem nearly severed. The sparrows always seem to have the last word in the matter, at least in our garden they do. I fancy that Providence must have originally intended to bring in an amending act, or whatever it's called, providing either for a less destructive sparrow or a more indestructible crocus. The one consoling point about our garden is that it's not visible from the drawing room or the smoking room, so unless people are dining or lunching with us, they can't spy out the nakedness of the land. That is why I'm so furious with Gwenda Pottington Dunn, who has practically forced herself on me for lunch Wednesday next. She heard me offer the Paulcoat girl lunch if she was shopping on that day, and of course she asked if she might come too. She was only coming to gloat over my bedraggled and flowerless borders and to sing the praises of her own detestably over-cultivated garden. I'm sick of being told that it's the envy of the neighborhood. It's like everything else that belongs to her, her car, her dinner parties, even her headaches. They're all superlative. No one else ever had anything like them. When her eldest child was confirmed, it was such a sensational event, according to her account of it, that one almost expected questions to be asked about it in the House of Commons. And now she's coming on purpose to stare at my few miserable pansies and the gaps in my sweet pea border, and to give me a glowing full-length description of the rare and sumptuous blooms in her rose garden. "My dear Eleanor," said the Baroness, "you would save yourself all this heartburning and a lot of the gardener's bills, not to mention sparrow anxieties, simply by paying an annual subscription to the OOSA." "Never heard of it," said Eleanor. "What is it?" "The OOSA." "The Occasional Oasis Supply Association," said the Baroness. "It exists to meet cases exactly like yours. Cases of backyards that are of no practical use for gardening purposes, but are required to blossom into decorative scenic backgrounds at stated intervals when a luncheon or dinner party is contemplated. Supposing, for instance, you have people coming to lunch at 1:30. You just ring up the association at about 10 o'clock the same morning and say, 'Lunch garden.' That is all the trouble you have to take. By 12:45, your yard is carpeted with a strip of velvety turf, with a hedge of lilac or red may, or whatever happens to be in season, as a background, one or two cherry trees in blossoms, and clumps of heavily flowered rhododendrons filling in the odd corners. In the foreground, you have a blaze of carnations or Shirley poppies or tiger lilies in full bloom. As soon as the lunch is over and your guests have departed the garden, the garden departs also, and all the cats in Christendom can sit in council in your yard without causing you a moment's anxiety. If you have a bishop or an antiquary or something of that sort coming to lunch, you just mention the fact when you are ordering the garden, and you get an old-world pleasance with clipped yew hedges and a sundial and hollyhocks and perhaps a mulberry tree and borders of sweet williams and canterbury bells and an old-fashioned beehive or two tucked away in the corner. Those are the ordinary lines of supply that the Oasis Association undertakes, but by paying a few guinea a year extra, you are entitled to its emergency EON service." "What on earth is an EON service?" It's just like a conventional signal to indicate special cases like the incursion of Gwenda Pottingdon. It means you've got someone coming to lunch or dinner whose garden is alleged to be the, quote, envy of the neighborhood, E-O-N. Yes, exclaimed Eleanor with some excitement, and what happens then? Something that sounds like a miracle out of the Arabian Nights. Your backyard becomes voluptuous with pomegranate and almond trees, lemon groves and hedges of flowering cactus, dazzling banks of azaleas, marble basin fountains, in which chestnut and white pond herons step daintily amid exotic water lilies, while golden pheasants strut about on alabaster terraces. The whole effect rather suggests the idea that Providence and Norman Wilkinson have dropped mutual jealousies and collaborated to produce a background for an open-air Russian ballet. In point of fact, it is merely the background to your luncheon party. If there is any kick left in Gwenda Pottingdon, or whoever your EON guest of the moment may be, just mention carelessly that your climbing putella is the only one in England since the one at Chatsworth died last winter. There isn't such a thing as a climbing putella, but Gwenda Pottingdon and her kind don't usually know one flower from another without prompting. Quick, said Eleanor, the address of the association. Gwenda Pottingdon did not enjoy her lunch. It was a simple yet elegant meal, excellently cooked and daintily served, but the piquant sauce of her own conversation was notably lacking. She had prepared a long succession of eulogistic comments on the wonders of her town garden with its unrivaled effects of horticultural magnificence, and, behold, her theme was shut in on every side by the luxuriant hedge of Siberian berries that, or berberis, that formed a glowing background to Eleanor's bewildering fragment of fairyland. The pomegranate and lemon trees, the terraced fountain, where golden carp slithered and wriggled amid the roots of gorgeous-hued irises, the banked masses of exotic blooms, the pagoda-like enclosure where Japanese sand badgers disported themselves, all these contributed to take away Gwenda's appetite and moderate her desire to talk about gardening matters. I can't say I admire the climbing putella, she observed so shortly, and anyway, it's not the only one of its kind in England. I happen to know of one in Hampshire. How gardening is going out of fashion. I suppose people haven't the time for it nowadays. Altogether, it was one of Eleanor's most successful luncheon parties. It was distinctly an unforeseen catastrophe that Gwenda should have burst in the household 4 days later at lunchtime and made her way unbidden into the dining room. I thought I must tell you that my Elaine has had a watercolor sketch accepted by the Latent Talent Art Guild. It's to be exhibited at their summer exhibition at the Hackney Gallery. It will be the sensation of the moment in the art world. Hello? What on earth has happened to your garden? It's not there. Suffragettes, said Eleanor promptly. Didn't you hear about it? They broke in and made hay of the whole thing in about 10 minutes. I was so heartbroken at the havoc that I had the whole place cleared out. I shall have it laid out again on rather more elaborate lines. That, she said to the Baroness afterwards, is what I call having an emergency brain. She's able to ad lib under pressure. So again, snobbiness. Competition. Third story we're doing today, the sheep. The sheep. Sheep. The sheep. The enemy had declared no trumps. Rupert played out his ace and king of clubs and cleared the adversary of that suit. Then the sheep, whom the fates had inflicted on him for a partner, took the third round with a queen of clubs and, having no other club to lead back, opened another suit. The enemy won the remainder of the tricks and the rubber. I had four more clubs to play. We only wanted the odd trick to win the rubber, said Rupert. But I hadn't another club to lead you, exclaimed the sheep with his ready defensive smile. It didn't occur to you to throw away your queen and my king and leave me with the command of the suit, said Rupert with polite bitterness. I suppose I ought to. I wasn't certain what to do. I'm awfully sorry, said the sheep. Being awfully and uselessly sorry formed a large part of his occupation in life. If a similar situation had arisen in subsequent hand, he would have blundered just as certainly, and he would have been just as irritatingly apologetic. Rupert stared gloomily across at him as he sat smiling and fumbling with his cards. Many men who have good brains for business do not possess the rudiments of a card brain, and Rupert would not have judged and condemned his prospective brother-in-law on the evidence of his bridge play alone. The tragic part of it was that he smiled and fumbled through life just as fatuously and apologetically as he did at the card table. And behind the defensive smile and the well-worn expressions of regret, there shone a scarcely believable but quite obvious self-satisfaction. Every sheep of the pasture probably imagines that in an emergency it could become terrible as an army with banners. One has only to watch how they stamp their feet and stiffen their necks when a minor object of suspicion comes into view and behaves meekly. And probably the majority of human sheep see themselves in imagination, taking great parts in the world's more impressive dramas, forming swift, unerring decisions in moments of crisis, cowing mutinies, allaying panics, brave, strong, simple, but, in spite of their natural modesty, always slightly spectacular. You're incredible. Why, in the name of all that is unnecessary and perverse, should Kathleen choose this man for her future husband? Was the question that Rupert asked himself, ruefully. There was young Malcolm Athling, as nice-looking, decent, level-headed a fellow as one could wish to meet, obviously her very devoted admirer, and yet she must throw herself away on this pale-eyed, weak-mouthed embodiment of self-serving ineptitude. If it had been merely Kathleen's own affair, Rupert would have shrugged his shoulders and philosophically hoped that she might make the best of an undeniably bad bargain, but Rupert had no heir. His own boy lay underground somewhere in the Indian frontier in goodly company, and the property would pass in due course to Kathleen and Kathleen's husband. The sheep would live there in the beloved old home, rearing up other little sheep, fatuous and rabbit-faced and self-satisfied like himself, to dwell in the land and possess it. It was not a soothing prospect. Towards dusk on the afternoon following the bridge experience, Rupert and the sheep made their way homeward after a day's mixed shooting. The sheep's cartridge bag was nearly empty, but his game bag showed no signs of overcrowding. The birds he had shot at seemed for the most part as impervious to death or damage as the hero of a melodrama. And for each failure to drop his bird, he had some explanation or apology ready in his lips. Now he was striding along in front of his host, chattering happily over his shoulder, but obviously on the lookout for some belated rabbit or wood pigeon that might happily be secured as an 11th-hour addition to his bag. As they passed the edge of a small copse, a large bird rose from the ground and flew slowly towards the trees, offering an easy shot to the oncoming sportsman. The sheep banged forth with both barrels and gave an exultant cry. "Hooray! I've shot a thundering big hawk!" To be exact, you shot a honey buzzard. That is the hen bird of one of the few pairs of honey buzzards breeding in the United Kingdom. We've kept them under the strictest preservation for the last 4 years. Every gamekeeper and village gun loafer for 20 miles round has been warned and bribed and threatened to respect their sanctity, and egg-snatching agents have been carefully guarded against during the breeding season. Hundreds of lovers of rare birds have delighted in seeing their snapshotted portraits in Country Life, the magazine, and now you've reduced the hen bird to a lump of broken feathers. Rupert spoke quietly and evenly, but for a moment or two, a gleam of positive hatred shone in his eyes. "I say, I'm so sorry," said the sheep, with his apologetic smile. "Of course, I remember hearing about the buzzards, but somehow I didn't connect this bird with them. It was such an easy shot."
"Yes," said Rupert, "that was the trouble."
Kathleen found him in the gun room, smoothing out the feathers of the dead bird. She had already been told of the catastrophe. "What a horrid misfortune," she said sympathetically.
"It was my dear Robbie who discovered them the last time he was home on leave. Don't you remember how excited he was about them? Let's go and have some tea."
Both bridge and shooting were given a rest for the next 2 or 3 weeks. Death, who enters into no compacts with party whips,
had forced a parliamentary vacancy on the neighborhood at the least convenient season, and the local partisans on either side found themselves immersed in the discomforts of a midwinter election. Rupert took his politics seriously and keenly. He belonged to that type of strangely but rather happily constituted individuals which these islands seem to produce in a fair plenty, men and women who for no personal profit or gain go forth from their comfortable firesides or club card rooms to hunt to and fro in the mud and rain and wind for the capture or tracking of a stray vote here and there in their party's behalf, not because they think they ought to, but because they want to. And his energies were welcome enough on this occasion, for the seat was a closely disputed possession. Its loss or retention would account for much in the present situation of the parliamentary game. With Kathleen to help him, he had worked his corner of the constituency with tireless, well-directed zeal, taking his share of the dull routine work as well as of the livelier episodes. The talking part of the campaign wound up on the eve of the poll with a meeting in the center where more undecided votes were supposed to be concentrated than anywhere else in the division. A good final meeting here would mean everything, and the speakers, local and imported, left nothing undone to improve the occasion. Rupert was down for the unimportant task of moving the complimentary vote to the chairman, which should close the proceedings. "I'm so hoarse," he protested when the moment arrived. "I don't believe I can make my voice heard beyond the platform." "Let me do it," said the sheep. "I'm rather good at that sort of thing." The chairman was popular with all parties, and the sheep's opening words of complimentary recognition received a round of applause. The orator smiled expansively on his listeners and seized the opportunity to add a few words of political wisdom on his own account. People looked at the clock or began to grope for umbrellas and discarded neck wraps. Then, in the midst of a string of meaningless platitudes, the sheep delivered himself of one of those blundering remarks which travel from one end of the constituency to the other in half an hour and are seized on by the other side as being more potent on their behalf than a ton of election literature. There was a general shuffling and muttering across the length and breadth of the hall, and a few hisses made themselves heard. The sheep tried to whittle down his remarks, and the chairman unhesitatingly threw him over in his speech of thanks, but the damage was done. I'm afraid I lost touch with the audience, rather, over that remark, said the sheep afterwards, with his apologetic smile abnormally developed. "You lost us the election," said the chairman, and he proved a true prophet. A month or so of winter sports seemed a desirable pick-me-up after the strenuous work and crowning discomfiture of the election. Rupert and Kathleen hied themselves away to a small alpine resort that was just coming into prominence, and thither the sheep followed them in due course in his role of husband-elect. The wedding had been fixed for the end of March. It was a winter of early and unseasonable thaws, and the far end of the local lake, at a spot where swift currents flowed into it, was decorated with notices written in three languages, warning skaters not to venture over certain unsafe patches. The folly of approaching too near these danger spots seemed to have a natural fascination for sheep. "I don't see what possible danger there can be," he protested with his inevitable smile, when Rupert beckoned him away from the proscribed area. "The milk that I put on my windowsill last night was frozen an inch deep." "It hadn't got a strong current flowing through it, though," was Rupert. "In any case, there is not much sense in hovering around a doubtful piece of ice when there are..." "Acres of good ice ready to skate over. The secretary of the ice committee has warned you once already." A few minutes later, Rupert heard a loud squeal of fear and saw a dark spot blotting the smoothness of the lake's frozen surface. The sheep was struggling, helplessly, in an ice hole of his own making. Rupert gave one loud curse and then dashed full tilt for the shore. Outside a low stable building on the lake's edge, he remembered having seen a ladder. If he could slide it across the ice hole before the sheep went under, the rescue would be comparatively simple work. other skaters were dashing up from a distance, and with the ladder's help, they could get him out of the death trap without having to trust themselves on the margin of rotten ice. Rupert sprang to the surface of lumpy, frozen snow and staggered to where the ladder lay. He had already lifted it when the rattle of a chain and furious outburst of growls burst on his hearing, and he was dashed to the ground by a mass of white and tawny fur. A sturdy young guard dog, frantic with the pleasure of performing his first piece of active guardian service, was ramping and snarling over him, rendering the task of regaining his feet or securing the ladder a matter of considerable difficulty. When he had at last succeeded in both efforts, he was just by a hair's breadth too late to be of any use. The sheep had definitely disappeared under the ice rift. Kathleen Athling and her husband stay the greater part of the year with Rupert, and a small Robbie stands in some danger of being idolized by a devoted uncle. But for 12 months of the year, Rupert's most inseparable and valued companion is a sturdy, tawny, and white yard dog. Last story we'll do will be The Oversight. "It's like a Chinese puzzle," said Lady Prouch, P-R-O-W-C-H-E, resentfully, staring at a scribbled list of names that spread over two or three loose sheets of notepaper on a writing table. Most of the names had a pencil mark running through them. "What is like a Chinese puzzle?" asked Lena Luddleford, briskly. She rather prided herself on being able to grapple with the minor problems of life. "Getting people suitably sorted together. Sir Richard likes me to have a house party about this time of year and gives me a free hand as to whom I should invite. All he asks is that it should be a peaceable party with no friction or unpleasantness." "That seems reasonable enough," said Lena. "Not only reasonable, my dear, but necessary. Sir Richard has his literary work to think of. You can't expect a man to concentrate on the tribal disputes of Central Asian clansmen when he's got social feuds blazing under his own roof." "But why should they blaze? Why should there be feuds at all within the compass of a house party?" "Exactly. Why should they blaze? Or why should they exist?" echoed Lady Prouch. "The point is that they always do. We have been unlucky, persistently unlucky, and now that I come to look back on things, we have always got people of violently opposed views under our roof, and the result has been not merely unpleasantness, but explosion." "Do you mean people who disagree on matters of political opinion and religious views?" asked Lena. "No, not that. The broader lines of political or religious difference don't matter. You can have Church of England and Unitarian and Buddhist under the same roof without courting disaster. The only Buddhist I ever had down here quarreled with everybody, but that was on account of his naturally squabblesome temperament. It had nothing to do with his religion. And I've always found that people can differ profoundly about politics and meet on perfectly good terms at breakfast. Now, Miss Larber Jones, who was staying here last year, worships Lloyd George as a sort of wingless angel." That's a good phrase to use, making fun of someone, a wingless angel. "While Mrs. Walters, who was down here at the same time, privately considers him to be an antelope, let us say." "An antelope?" "Well, not an antelope exactly, but something with horns and hoof and tail." "Oh, I see." "Still, that didn't prevent them from being the chummiest of mortals on the tennis court and in the billiard room. They did quarrel, finally, about a lead in a doubled hand of no trumps. But that, of course, is a thing that no amount of judicious guest grouping could prevent. Mrs. Walters had got king, knave, 10, and 7 of clubs. You were saying that there were other lines of demarcation that caused the bother," interrupted Lena. "Exactly. It is the minor differences and the side issues that give so much trouble," said Lady Prouch. "Not to my dying day shall I forget last year's upheaval over the suffragette question. Laura Hennessy left the house in a state of speechless indignation, but before she had reached that state, she had used language that would not have been tolerated in the Austrian Reichsrath. Intensive
bear gardening was Sir Richard's description of the whole affair, and I don't think he exaggerated. Of course, the suffragette question is a burning one and lets loose the most dreadful ill feeling, said Lena, but one can generally find out beforehand what people's opinions. My dear, the year before it was worse. It was Christian Science. Selina Gooby is a sort of high priestess of the cult, and she put down all opposition with a high hand. Then one evening after dimmer, Clovis Sangrail put a wasp down her back to see if her theory about the non-existence of pain could be depended on in an emergency. The wasp was small but very efficient, and it had been soured in temper by being kept in a paper cage all the afternoon. Wasps don't stand confinement well, at least this one didn't. I don't think I ever realized till that moment what the word invective, quote-unquote, could be made to mean. I sometimes wake in the night and think I still hear Selina describing Clovis's conduct and general character. That was the year that Sir Richard was writing his volume on domestic life in Tartary. The critics all blamed it for a lack of concentration. He's engaged on a very important work this year, isn't he? Asked Lena. Land tenure in Turkestan, said Lady Proud. She is just at work on the final chapters, and they require all the concentration he can give them. That is why I am very anxious not to have any unfortunate disturbance this year. I have taken every precaution I can think of to bring non-conflicting and harmonious elements together. The only two people I am not quite easy about are the Atkinson man and Marcus Popham. They are the two who will be down here longest together, and if they are going to fall foul of one another about any burning question, well, there will be more unpleasantness. Can't you find out anything about them, about their opinions, I mean? Anything. My dear Lena, there's scarcely anything I haven't found out about them. There's scarcely anything I haven't found out about them. They're both of them moderate liberal, evangelical, mildly opposed to female suffrage. They approve of the Falconer Report and the steward's decision about Cragonor. Thank goodness in this country we don't fly into violent passions about Wagner and Brahms and things of that sort. There is only one thorny subject I haven't been able to make sure about, the only stone that I have left unturned. Are they unanimously anti-vivisectionist, or do they both uphold the necessity for scientific experiment? There has been a lot of correspondence on the subject in our local newspapers of late, and the vicar is certain to preach a sermon or two about it. Vicars are dreadfully provocative at times. Now, if you could only find out for me whether these two men are divergently for or against. I, exclaimed Lena, how am I to find out? I don't know either of them to speak to. Still, you might discover in some roundabout way. Write to them, under an assumed name, of course, for subscriptions to one or another cause, or better still, send a stamped typewritten reply postcard with a request for a declaration for or against vivisection. People who would hesitate to commit themselves to a subscription will cheerfully write yes or no in a prepaid postcard. If you can't manage it that way, try and meet them at someone's house and get them into argument on the subject. I think Millie occasionally has one or the other of them at her at-home times. You might have the luck to meet both of them there at the same evening. Only it must be done soon. My invitations ought to go out by Wednesday or Thursday at the latest. Today is Friday. Millie's at-homes are not very amusing as a rule, said Lena, and one never gets a chance of talking uninterruptedly to anyone for a couple of minutes at a time. Millie is one of those restless hostesses who always seem to be trying to see how you look in different parts of the room and fresh grouping effects. Even if I got to speak to Popham or Atkinson, I couldn't plunge into a topic like vivisection straight away. No, I think the postcard scheme would be more hopeful and decidedly less tiresome. How would it be best to word them? Oh, something like this. Are you in favor of experiments on living animals for the purpose of scientific research? Yes or no? That is quite simple and unmistakable. If they don't answer it, well, it will at least be an indication that they are indifferent about the subject, and that is all I want to know. All right, said Lena. I'll get my brother-in-law to let me have them addressed to his office, and he can telephone the result of the plebiscite direct to you. Thank you ever so much.
said Lady Prowch gratefully, and be sure to get the card sent off as soon as possible. On the following Tuesday, the voice of an office clerk, speaking through the telephone, informed Lady Prowch that the postcard poll showed unanimous hostility to experiments on living animals. Lady Prowch thanked the office clerk, and in a loud and more fervent voice, she thanked heaven. The two invitations, already sealed and addressed, were immediately dispatched. In due course, they were both accepted. The house party of the Halcyon Hours, as the prospective hostess called it, was auspiciously launched. Halcyon's kind of like sweet or wonderful, I believe. Peaceful, at least. Lena Luttleford was not included among the guests, having previously committed herself to another invitation. At the opening day of a cricket festival, however, she ran across Lady Prowch, who had motored over from the other side of the county. She wore the air of one who was not interested in cricket and not particularly interested in life. She shook hands limply with Lena and remarked that it was a beastly day. "The party, how's it gone off?" asked Lena quickly. "Don't speak of it," was the tragical answer. "Why do I always have such rotten luck?" "But what has happened?" "It has been awful. Hyenas could not have behaved with greater savagery. Sir Richard said so, and he has been in countries where hyenas live, so we ought to know. They actually came to blows." "Blows? Blows and curses. It really might have been a scene from one of Hogarth's pictures. I never felt so humiliated in all my life." "What the servants must have thought." "But who are the offenders?" "Oh, naturally, the very two that we took all the trouble about." "I thought they agreed on every subject that one could violently disagree about. Religion, politics, vivisection, the Derby decision, the Falconer report. What else was there left to quarrel about?" "My dear, we were fools not to have thought of it. One of them was pro-Greek and the other pro-Bulgar." Okay, I guess it escapes me why even 100 years ago that would have been a resounding punchline, but hey, man, if everything were explicable and understood, there wouldn't be any thrilling mysteries, I guess. Well, that will wrap it up for today. Four stories, like Billy Bob Thornton said in Bad Santa, well, they can't all be winners. When the kid unwrapped a candy corn in his advent calendar, I always liked that line. They can't all be winners. These were a little subpar. I gotta speak from the heart. I don't think they were as good as usual stuff, but we'll give them a break. Give her a break. All right. Well, thanks for being with me. I'll be back with you again more for real, for more and hopefully better stories from Soggy Real soon.